we humans built our anthropogenic world without paying attention to circadian rhythm. And now we have a crisis of circadian disruption, which is very pervasive.
Aging. Like gravity, it pulls on each of us. Why do some of us age without illness? How do our bodies and minds experience aging at the cellular and molecular level? What's the future of aging in our society? And maybe most importantly, what can we do about it today? My name is Gordon Lithgow, and here at the Buck Institute in California, my colleagues and I are searching for and actually finding answers to these questions and many more. On this podcast, we discuss and discover the future of aging with some of the brightest scientific stars on the planet. We're not getting any younger yet. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. This is going to be so much fun because today I get to talk to Sachin Panda from the Salk Institute. Sachin does amazing work on how sleep and diet and how we experience our everyday lives affects our aging, and is a really remarkable scientist that builds bridges between the biology and our everyday experiences. I'm delighted and honored to have Professor Sachin Panda on the podcast today. Wow, how are you?
Good.
You know, I look at your body of work and I just think about how influential it currently is. I barely a day goes by without someone talking to me and talking about time-restricted feeding or circadian rhythms, and it really is an incredible influence that you're having on people's health right now. And so it's very exciting to talk to you about that. Sachin, this is something you've articulated extremely well, is how much of our health is potentially under our control if we put our mind to it. And, you know, your book, The Circadian Code, really lays out a plan for us to be much more mindful about our health and what we can do about it. At the same time, you know, that there is genetic influences, and I want to get to genetics in a bit, but for human life expectancy, it seems like genetics isn't a big deal, right?
Yeah, I would say that genetics is not a big deal. I mean, there is always interaction between genes and environment, but when it comes to extending lifespan, for example, if we can study supercentenarians and see whether they have a genetic makeup, the question is, it becomes very difficult to figure out what is the contribution of lifelong exposure to different factors, nutrition, physical activity, sleep, then pollutions and other factors. So since it's very difficult to measure that part, then it becomes difficult to figure out whether somebody who lived up to the age of 90, 95, and for example, it's not good business, but who was a lifelong smoker, for example, was there a gene that actually dented the bad impact of smoking? So similarly, we do find there are a lot of people who are overweight and maybe medically obese, but they do live to the age of 80, 85 with perfectly normal cognitive ability and intellectual ability performance. And those are the areas where there's huge potential for discovery.
So we've had many guests on the podcast that are interested in aging interventions that are more drug-like, you know, finding chemical compounds or natural products or metabolites that potentially could extend health span. And it seems like you're not waiting for these. Your strategies are for now, and there's no need for these interventions. Do you think that circadian rhythms and even the sort of feeding cycles are druggable things within themselves?
Yeah, so this is where two things come. One is the drugs that we know the geroscience community wants to promote in humans. The question is part of their effect on longevity mediated through circadian clock. Second, whether those drugs can be optimized for specific time of the day so that we can even increase the efficacy. So, for example, if you're giving metformin at the wrong time of the day, maybe you'll not see much benefit. Is there a right time of the day where you can give metformin for better results? Same thing goes for rapamycin and many of the other drugs that are under trial right now. So the timing of drug is another important aspect of circadian rhythm because we know that nearly 85% of FDA-approved drug targets themselves are circadian, or their metabolism is circadian, or their absorption is circadian. In fact, metformin does have very different effect even on glucose regulation in healthy or diseased mice, whether it's given in morning or evening. The second question is, are there drugs that can reactivate circadian clock components? And if they do, then what are the benefits? And this is the case where there are at least two different compounds. One is drugs that target one of the component of the clock, rebirth, alpha and beta, which are nuclear hormone receptors. These are developed by Scripps Research, so that's why the name is SR9009, 9011. And now we know that these SR compounds are very effective against treating age-related disease, whether it's metabolic disease, liver disease, cancer. We published a paper on that, dementia, etc. So there is hope that even drugging the clock can be beneficial. And then there is also another one, nobilitin, which is a citrus extract, which also improves the robustness of the clock. And there are animal studies showing that it improves health and makes them resilient to age-related disease. So, yes, from drug
Yes.
perspective, the current drugs for extended lifespan should be tested for their efficacy at different time of the day. And clocks are druggable, and those drugs, sometimes even food supplement or food, they may hold promise to improve lifespan.
Super. It makes me think about the fact that we're all wondering whether things like metformin are going to work for everyone, or if genetic background is going to be a major influence, and actually in worms, genetic backgrounds is a huge influence on whether you respond to metformin or not. And it reminds me of the studies with caloric restriction, where different genetic background mice, different isogenic lines, respond in sometimes opposite ways to the same level of caloric restriction. And I'm wondering if this is something you think about in terms of even time-restricted feeding, whether this is something that has to be catered to the individual based on the genetics.
Yeah, so of course, those who are more prone to hypoglycemia, whether they should be doing time restricting of 8 hours or 12 hours or 10 hours is an important issue. Something goes for people who actually want to build up their muscle mass and want to eat more to prevent sarcopenia. The question is, can they absorb enough nutrient within that 6 or 8 hours? Because there is a craze about 6 or 8 hours to maintain that. So, hopefully, in the next few years, we'll have more and more data because we do have an app called My Circadian Clock that is being used in at least now a dozen different clinical trials. The nice thing is we can have meta-analysis of all these results that are collected on the same platform so we can analyze them for this obvious reason. Are there specific type of time restricting that are better for some people than the other? And since we're also collecting sleep data and activity data, then the question is there interaction between sleep and time restricting? Because if you're doing time restricting but not sleeping enough, does that reduce the benefit of time restricting? Or if you're eating very healthy diet, but with eating within 12 hours, not 8, and sleeping enough, is that as good as time restricting within 8 hours? All these interactions will come up in future years. But we just woke up to its importance because we humans built our anthropogenic world without paying attention to circadian rhythm. And now we have a crisis of circadian disruption, which is very pervasive. Almost every single person will go through at least a few years of chronic circadian rhythm disruption. And we'll come to that. what I mean by circadian rhythm disruption. And that circadian rhythm disruption for a few weeks, months, or years can compromise resilience in many cases, flare up certain disease, can increase risk for disease. And then if somebody already has disease, then the prognosis or cure becomes difficult. If somebody is cured, then coming back to full performance also becomes difficult. And we all can relate to all of this because we humans will go through, in our lifetime, we'll go through various bouts of sickness, whether it's infectious disease, whether it's, for example, common cold to serious disease, accidents, injuries, depression, etc. And then the question is, we need intervention, or we need something simple that can prevent, manage, reverse, and accelerate cure from these diseases. And only then we can think of how to increase lifespan. Because on a day-to-day basis, we are not thinking about whether I would make it to 150 years. What we are all concerned about is, can I maintain my performance today? And can I come back to full performance tomorrow? So in this context, circadian rhythm, or the timing of food, exercise, and sleep, becomes important, and it's within our control.
So paint a picture for me of the perfect situation with circadian rhythms. What's the perfect picture of a healthy person?
Yeah, so this is always debatable because people always say, oh, well, I'm not in that perfect situation. And another thing is, as people live in different latitude and in different seasons, then what is considered perfect or optimal may be different for different seasons. But let's start with some rule of thumb that everybody can relate, and there is enough science to back this up. So one thing is, first thing is, our day actually begins on the night before. So that means the previous night, what time we decided to go to bed has a huge influence on how we perform today. So in that sense, the rule number one is, the formula number one is, try to go to bed at a consistent time and be in bed for at least 8 hours. So that you can get 7 to 7.5 hours of sleep, restorative sleep. Why that is important is there are a lot of epidemiological studies in all continents that have shown that people who sleep somewhere between 6.5 hours and 7.5 hours appear to have less disease, and they seem to have slightly longer lifespan. So having this 6.5 to 7.5 hours of sleep for adults is very important. And when it comes to younger adults, for example, children up to teenagers, they actually need more sleep, so 8 to 9 hours. And during sleep, there are a lot of things going on. One is, for example, growth hormone spike that happens in the first couple of hours of sleep. And growth hormone is extremely important for repair, rejuvenation of many parts of our body, including our gut lining, our skin, all the epithelial cells or cells that are exposed to the outside environment.
I just turned 30 a few months ago. Oh, no, wait a minute, 60. And so what should I expect now? For that picture is potentially going to change for me, right?
Yeah, so still it's 6.5 to 7.5 hours of restorative sleep is very important. What happens is, as we get older, our arousal threshold reduces. So that means small disturbances in our sleep environment can wake us up. It's possible that there was some noise. It was possible that your core body temperature increased, or your bed was warmer, or for example, if you woke up to go to the bathroom, then your arousal threshold is pretty low and sleep pressure is pretty low, so it becomes difficult to go back. So the way I look at it is, you know, when you are younger, it's almost like your body almost runs on a self-driving mode. And then as you're in middle age, it switches to like the automatic mode, but you still have to take care of it. And then as we get older, it's almost like a manual driving for humans. We have to pay attention to
Yeah,
You really have
yeah.
to pay attention to all these levels. So during sleep, we also there is synaptic plasticity of the brain cells connect with each other, and then there is cleaning up toxins from our brain and body. So that's why all of these are important. So the number one is try to go to bed at a consistent time and be in bed for 8 hours so that you can get 6.5 hours of restorative sleep.
Okay, and you touched on it there, but I mean, do we have a reasonable understanding of the biology behind why aging is driving these changes?
We really don't have any good understanding of how aging reduces sleep pressure or reduces arousal threshold or reduces our recovery from loss of sleep. So, for example, when you are younger, if we lose one night of sleep, the next day there is enough sleep pressure that we will stay in bed until noon. And that's what happens with teenagers, the high school and college students. They would stay in bed up to 1, 2 in the afternoon on the weekends. But as we get older, our brain cannot process how much sleep debt we have and how much our body requires that sleep to be recovered. And this is one fundamental question of aging biology or geroscience, how a brain forgets or loses track of how many hours of sleep we need and how many hours of sleep we are getting.
Just thinking about circadian rhythms, it's impossible for me not to think about Seymour Benzer and those studies that determined genes and proteins that really were the circadian clocks. So Seymour Benzer discovers these proteins that are actually measuring time in some way. And first of all, I guess the question is it the same kind of thing that's happening in mammals and humans?
Yeah, so this is where it becomes very, I would say, philosophical, or because there is some correlation going on here. So the reason why we have the need for tracking time is, life form appeared on this planet maybe 3 to 4 billion years ago, and there has been only one constant for the last 3 to 4 billion years. That is, our planet is rotating around its axis, and then there is 24 hours rhythm in light and darkness. So that means every organism on this planet is experiencing this very profound change in light and darkness, and it's predictable change in light and darkness. And with these changes, there is change in humidity level, there is change in temperature, there is change in availability of food, and for plants, availability of sunlight, that's the primary source of photosynthesis or carbon fixation. And as we all know, to anticipate time and getting ready gives us a very fundamental survival advantage. For example, we schedule this podcast at 11 o'clock, and at 10:45, there was an alarm that went off. And then I thought, okay, so I got to get ready for this podcast so that I don't want to be late for this. And the same thing happens. The plants have to prepare their apparatus so that they can catch the first ray of light and convert and use it to make carbohydrate, fix carbon. Similarly, animals, or we humans, have to prepare our body even before we wake up by increasing heart rate, increasing blood flow, increasing respiration, so that when we wake up, we feel rested and we feel full of energy. So that's anticipating time to prepare ourselves. And second is separating incompatible process and conversely combining compatible process. So for example, our physiology is designed in such a way that we actually consolidate our sleep to the night time. At the same time, our hunger and satiety signals are also arranged so that we can go through the entire night, 8, 10, 12, or 14 hours, without feeling excessively hungry. And this hunger, satiety, sleep, wake, and also activity rest. So, for example, our muscle tone is much better in the late afternoon, because that's when our ancestral hunter-gatherers and farmers, they were running back to safe place to spend overnight darkness. And just imagine if your muscle tone was at its peak in the middle of the night, then we'd be acting out our dreams and essentially telling
Yeah.
predators, hey, I'm here, come and eat me. So this is the fundamental, at the whole organism level, these are the function of circadian clocks. So that's why we all have clocks. And in fact, if you look at all the animals and microbes, etc., those who have a circadian clock, they do live longer than those who do not have a circadian clock, those species. So you would not find a species that lives more than a month and doesn't have a circadian clock.
So where is the clock in our body?
So initially, people thought that the clocks must be only in the nervous system because the nervous system controls sleep-wake cycle and everything. And again, it goes back to Ron Konopka and Seymour Panjer because they challenged this idea. Ron and Seymour had found that if you decapitate a fly, so that means if you remove the head, the body actually stays alive and there is still circadian rhythm and activity. That body, the fly body, will actually walk around for almost more than 12 hours and there was circadian rhythm. So they had indicated that there must be clocks everywhere else. And then what is the role of the brain clock? So they, when they had all these poor mutant flies, they actually took the head from, they did the head transplant. Literally, they put the head in the abdomen of other flies and found that you can change the circadian rhythm of activity rest by changing the head.
Astonishing, astonishing.
So, it's just... But later on, we found that clocks are present in almost every cell in human body, animal body. For example, if you take skin fibroblasts from humans, then there are clocks in those skin fibroblasts. So clocks are everywhere.
And the clocks are talking to each other? Is there one governing organ or principle that's setting those clocks in each of the other tissues?
Yeah, so the idea is there is a master clock in 20,000 neurons in the brain of animals and humans. So these are called, this particular brain center is called suprachiasmatic nucleus. So that means it's right above the optic chiasma where the right and left optic nerves crisscross. There are roughly 20,000 neurons. They cluster together to the size of a pinhead. And those neurons somehow have assumed the role of master regulators, because if we remove those 20,000 neurons, then the animal has no sense of time. They eat, then go back to sleep for 2 to 3 hours, and then wake up and move around again. So in terms of aging, the idea is, maybe as we get older, then some of the SCN, suprachiasmatic nucleus neurons, either they become defective, they cannot generate rhythms, or the communication between them becomes weaker so that they cannot consolidate rhythms. And in fact, in many cases of Alzheimer's disease and neurodegenerative disease, people have found postmortem that the SCN neurons have signs of degeneration, and that might explain why sleep-wake cycle becomes fragmented in many dementia patients.
It makes me wonder, are there any gender differences in circadian rhythm degradation during aging or even in young people?
There are gender differences and also age differences, how our intrinsic rhythms are organized. For example, we know that many kids, babies, for example, they wake up early. Means those who are babies, they know that the babies wake up very early. But as we hit puberty, then somehow there is some interaction between sex hormones and circadian clock, so that teenagers have intrinsic drive to sleep, go to bed later, and also wake up later. And that's very well established in human literature. And as we, as women hit menopause, or we males also reach age of 50, 55, again, we go back to the state of the little kids. So then we tend to go to bed a little earlier and also get up a little earlier.
So it sounds like actually this is in line with possibly our evolutionary history and what we're doing. And before we begin to wrap up here, Sachin, I need to ask you, what's so bad about blue light?
Yeah, so the blue light, the story goes back that our circadian rhythm, particularly the SCN, the suprachiasmatic nucleus clock, it has to be in alignment with the night cycle although our ancestors did not fly across time zone or did not do shift work, there was a constant change in day length. We know that the day length or the sunrise time is slightly different from one week to another week. And the clock, our activity sleep cycle should also align with that. And that alignment happens through light perceived through the eyes and acting on the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And for a long time, scientists knew that people who are blind because they have lost rod and cone cells can still entrain their clock. And similarly, mice that have lost rod and cone cells that give us vision, they can also reset their clock. But if you remove the eyes from animals, then they cannot entrain their clock. So we, three different independent labs in around 2001, we discovered that there is a blue light sensing protein called melanopsin that's present in the retina. The surviving neurons of the blind mice and blind humans that can sense blue light and reset the clock. And subsequently, the function of these blue light sensing proteins have expanded. We now know that the same cells connect to part of the brain that controls depression or feeling happier. So that means during daytime, we should be exposed to a little bit more of daylight, not looking at the sun, but even under the shade or sitting next to a large window. That increases alertness, reduces depression. And at nighttime, we should reduce our exposure to bright light, bright LED light, and should dim down our light to for better sleep.
Right. You know, in some ways, you've set out a blueprint for a healthier life for all of us, and it's a spectacular body of work. And I guess what I'm interested in right now is what are you interested in right now? What are the big questions that you want to now go and solve?
The holy grail of circadian rhythm is why some animals are day active, why some animals are night active. What makes us diurnal or nocturnal?
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, can we understand this very fundamental rule and then change it in a way to address the emerging problems for our next generation? Because if we know what controls our master circadian clock, for example, in humans, those who are doing shift work or those kids who are staying up all night to cram for exam, can we reduce their long-term health disruption due to circadian rhythm? That's in the health side. And in agriculture, for example, we know that there are many crops that flower during daytime and they fertilize and then they produce grains, for example, rice flowers in the early morning. As global warming, as the planet warms up, then these flowers actually, as soon as they open, they wilt and they die. So the yield goes down. So there is another case, if we know the fundamental principle of circadian rhythm, maybe we can find new rice varieties, new crop varieties that actually flower in the middle of the night, for example, when it's cooler, so that they have much better chance of survival and producing, sustaining crop growth. So,
that's fascinating. That's amazing.
Yes, there are multiple use of understanding fundamental principles of circadian rhythms.
So obviously smartphones and wearables are a major tool in your research going forward. And it just begs the question, what should we all be doing today if we're not babies, we're not teenagers?
Yeah, so we kind of started. So be in bed for 8 hours so that you can get 6.5 to 7 hours of sleep. After waking up, wait for at least 1, ideally 2 hours before your first meal, because that's when the stress hormone and the sleep hormones are kind of crisscrossing each other. We don't go into the biology of it, but the bottom line is our body is not ready to eat and absorb nutrient. After waiting for 2 hours, then have your first meal, breakfast at a consistent time, eat within 8, 9, 10, or maximum 12 hours. That's number three. And the fourth is try to get at least 30 minutes of daylight. Fifth one is try to get at least 30 minutes of physical activity every day, ideally in the afternoon, because that's good for reducing blood pressure and reducing blood sugar, particularly for older adults, and reducing risk for injury. And number six is 2 to 3 hours before your habitual bedtime, avoid food and avoid bright light. Those are the six pillars.
Wonderful. What a great summary. Professor Sachin Pandit, thank you so much for this time we've had together today.
Good to see you.
thank you for listening. Please subscribe, share, and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're Not Getting Any Younger Yet is produced by Vital Mind Media. The Buck Institute's very own Robin Snyder is the executive producer. Wellington Bowler is right next to me here, directing the recordings. Stella B is behind the scenes, ready to debrief when we wrap. And the esteemed Sharif Izzat weaves the show together for you. If you're listening to the podcast, you'll know that there has never been a more exciting time in the research on aging. Discoveries in the lab are moving to the clinic to help us all live better, longer. The Buck Institute depends on the support of people like you to carry on our breakthrough research. Please visit us at buckinstitute.org to learn more and to donate.